Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice, the RN show about getting stuff done at work. Let's begin with stupidity. Unless you're very unusual, you probably do stupid things. It's part of being human. But a couple of business school academics weren't satisfied with that. Mats Alvesson, who's at Lund University in Sweden, and Andre Spicer at the Cass Business School in London, wanted to find out why. Specifically, they wanted to know why smart people do stupid things at work. Their research identifies something they call functional stupidity. Here's Andre Spicer.
Normally when we think about stupidity, we think about someone with a low IQ. But functional stupidity points to the fact that it's often the smartest people who can do the stupidest things. So functional stupidity is the idea that people don't use their intelligence. They don't ask questions. They don't reflect on their assumptions. Therefore, they either buy into a stupid idea or do a stupid thing. So that's the stupid part of it. The functional part is that often we think stupidity leads to mistakes or failures. But functionality means that it actually works. So functional stupidity, in a nutshell, is this idea that stupidity can lead to things actually working out for us sometimes, at least in the short term.
How does it sort of manifest? Is it a kind of closing down of things like curiosity or making sure you're always positive, or what is it?
We spent a long time studying workplaces that hire a lot of intelligent people. And what we noticed is they came into work, these great degrees, high IQs, very curious. And then slowly but surely, they were kind of poked and prodded to not use that intelligence. So the way it manifests was that they wouldn't ask questions. They wouldn't be curious and look beyond the obvious answer. They would buy into a very positive and upbeat message, even though they knew that there were problems.
So this is an emperor's new clothes thing. There's something wrong, but we're choosing not to see it.
Indeed. So oftentimes in workplaces, if you go in and take people aside and say, hey, what's the real problem here? People will say, no one's ever asked me that. And they will actually tell you what's going on, what the problems are. But during their everyday work, they often don't speak up, don't point out what the problems are, don't actually use their intelligence. Why? Because it's often dangerous or it doesn't pay off for them to do it. If they actually used their intelligence, they'd be seen as a troublemaker or maybe not seen as leadership material. They'd cause problems amongst their colleagues and perhaps not get that promotion that they might want.
The end result of this is that you've got bright people buying into stupid ideas.
Indeed, when we looked at many organizations like engineering companies, consultancies, what we found is that they often buy into ideas which even a high school student would find ridiculous. Let me give you examples. If we think about, say, a much leadership development these days, these are kind of things that you would found in a hippie new age commune 10, 15, 20 years ago, and people enthusiastically buy into them. If you go into I know there's large banks in Australia today, they distribute colouring in books to their employees to sit there and get rid of their stress. If you look at rebranding exercises, I think the Australian Opera changed its name to Opera Australia, or perhaps it was the other way around. And we often see these rebranding exercises where they just reverse the name and spend millions in the process. Most people will tell you it doesn't really achieve much, but we go ahead and do it anyway.
What I'm struck by in going through the book, this is something that's happening in what we think of as knowledge-intensive workplaces, so places that are full of bright people.
Yes. We were struck by so many companies put up this image of themselves as being knowledge intensive. And to all intents and purposes, they were. They hired bright people from the best universities. They tested them for their IQ. And what we found is that they often came in very enthusiastic to use their intelligence. But within a few days, they weren't actually using the things which they've been trained to do. And our big question was, why was this happening? And we found that there were kind of two things going on here. Number one was, these were smart people, so they realized that it wouldn't pay off often to use their intelligence to the full extent. Number two, if they did begin using their intelligence to the full extent, asking those tough questions, looking into the evidence, they would often be given a little bit of a prod by their co-workers. Hey, don't make life difficult for us. This is only going to create problems. It's going to take a lot longer than expected. The third thing we saw happening was, if you persisted in it, your boss might come by and say, hey, well, you know, I know you've got some good ideas here, but we just need to get this project finished, or we just need to get this through, or my manager is asking for me to do this. I know it's a bad idea, but we need to do it anyway.
It does make one skeptical, but you're actually skeptical more broadly about knowledge workers and knowledge intensive firms and the knowledge economy.
Indeed. So if we look at Malcolm Turnbull, I think it was in the summer, he launched his big new package for the future of Australia. So you can no longer be the world's quarry. So you need to become the world's sort of knowledge quarry, if you like. So this future of knowledge intensive firms. This idea has been around since 1962, when it came out in a newspaper piece in the New York Times. So from there, you saw the rise of knowledge work a bit. But according to many estimates, since around about 2000, at least in places like the UK and US, knowledge-intensive jobs, which are things like that where you're using theoretical knowledge to do the work, have either been flatlining or actually in decline. If you look at any Western developed economy, the areas which are growing quickest isn't these kind of very smart jobs like computer programmer or web designer or whatever. It's actually routine service work. So for every one computer programmer, there are three people out there flipping hamburgers. So instead of this knowledge-intensive work, we often find quite the opposite if we actually look at the picture.
It's not only that, though. Your research suggests that many of the jobs that are so-called knowledge-intensive aren't really that knowledge-intensive at all.
Indeed. So we went looking for these knowledge-intensive jobs. We went into consultancy firms, law firms, media organisations even, universities, all of these places where you think smart things happen. And what we found when we spoke with people doing this work is that oftentimes they would describe their job as being dumb. You would say, so what do you do during the day? Well, I'm a spreadsheet monkey. What counts around here? Well, one or two good PowerPoint slides. Or how do you know what's the right thing to do? Well, I just do what my boss tells me or what's popular at the time. So we didn't actually find a lot of evidence of these knowledge workers actually using their brain, which, to be quite honest, was quite shocking to us.
Yeah, and I mean, the story that we're told again and again is that, you know, there's these places that people want to work, Google and Facebook and Apple, and or if you want to go down the finance route, Goldman Sachs, and everybody there is bright and numerate and trying to think of new ways of doing things and earning megabucks.
Well, that's partially true. But if you actually look and begin digging deeper into these organizations, what you'll often find is quite a different picture emerges. So let me give you one example. I had one of my students recently, and I thought this guy's got a great career in front of him. He gets offered a job at Google, and it's basically doing fairly routine sales. Google never tells you that there's a huge sales force that's involved in this company. Now this guy thought, well, I can probably do better than that. So he went off, and actually he's involved in a startup, I think, in Australia at the moment, strangely enough. So the point I'm trying to raise here is that often these great companies have this routine jobs. Another example, IBM, I think, has their slogan is like working smarter. And IBM do employ a small number of people who are, you know, Nobel Prize winners or developing smart technology. But the vast majority of people working in IBM are doing, again, routine work like sales, plus also things like working in call centers. So the advantage of calling your firm a knowledge-intensive firm, when you have smart people who come and work for you, who get a little bit, say, dissatisfied with their job, then they can go home to their friends and family and they say, what do you do for a living? And they can say, well, I work for IBM or I work for Google. They don't have to say, I work in a call center.
No. All right. Well, let's return to functional stupidity. You've identified essentially five kinds of it. So it's induced by different things. And one of them, and this is, I suppose, the one that's probably most obvious, and that's leadership. So the leadership itself is inducing this functional stupidity within an organization.
Yeah, so there are a couple of sides to this. So on the one hand, it's this idea that leadership is coming along and saying, just don't think about it, do it. We're the leaders, we have the vision, and you are the followers. But the other side, which I think is often overlooked, is that leadership as an idea itself can bewitch people who are want to be leaders. So if you go into any organization today and ask, what's your role? Most people want to avoid being seen as a manager because that's not very sexy or interesting. They want to be seen as a leader with a grand vision and a vision for the future. And if you take those people aside, which we did, follow them for a few days, ask them what they do, you'd find that basically they'd say, well, 99% of the time I basically do administration, or I sit in boring meetings with other managers, and only 1% or 2% of my time I get to do what would they call leadership. And you say, well, what's this leadership you're doing? Well, I met someone in a corridor and I said to them, you know, happy birthday, or I, you know, these kind of things. This is what people point out that they say is leadership, which is caring for people and stuff. Whereas most of the time, the reality of most management jobs is boring administration work.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to argue with that. Andre, this is so interesting, but it's also much worse than I thought it was. What can we do?
The key thing here is giving people a space to ask questions, critique assumptions, to actually use their intelligence. One easy step towards this is to encourage people to use their natural critical faculties. And you can do this through a range of ways. One, which I quite like, is using what we call a devil's advocate. So most companies are basically full of yes men. So people, they say, yes, that's a great idea. Yes, we need to be optimistic. But what a devil's advocate would do is put someone into the group who's actually a no man or a no woman. Now, why is that good? Well, it means that people have to begin to question their assumptions, ask whether this is the right thing to do. It gives them pause for thought. The second idea we have is a pre-mortem. So a post-mortem is you look at the body after it's died and see what went wrong. A pre-mortem is that you look at the body before it dies and work out how you might save it. When you begin a project, you sit down with the group and you say, okay, imagine in 6 months' time there's been a major screw-up. Write down all the things that you think went deeply wrong. And then people in the group who have done it before can come up with a huge long list, and they're shaking their head and laughing. And then you write them down and you say, okay, what can we do to deal with that? And you can then come up with a list. Now, this has two effects. Number one is that it forces people to look on the negative side of potentially what might go wrong in the future in a project. The second thing is it gets rid of this kind of positivity bias people have. So any of you are out of your listeners out there who have done renovations to a house will normally think it's going to cost half as much and take half the amount of time it actually takes. It's the same thing with most corporate projects. They tend to cost double the amount and take double the time. Now, if you were actually realistic at the beginning, you would plan better. And that's what a pre-mortem tries to do. I think a third thing which we might do is getting rid of a lot of the corporate bullshit which we see. So this is meaningless ideas, empty things that everyone thinks is a ridiculous idea. So imagine if we had kind of a day where people in the organization actually said, well, what's all these empty BS which we see around the organization? How can we get rid of it? So this idea by going around getting rid of these meaningless things which were introduced 10 or 15 years ago would make absolutely everyone's life far better, I would say.
The sound you can hear is me desperately trying to keep my facial muscles straight. You were talking before about the elephants in the room. I'm concerned that the elephant in the room with all of those ideas you've just been explaining is that for any of them to be implemented, the people in charge have to face up to the fact that they have this functional stupidity culture.
Absolutely. And it's seeing your own stupidity is one of the hardest things to do. And often it can be impossible. So let me give you an example of what happened at Nokia. Nokia, I think in 2007, was the world's biggest mobile phone maker. It was a leading company. And at this point in time, it realized that the iPhone was coming. So they had to develop a new generation of smartphones. And by the way, Nokia was the first person to develop smartphone technology. They had all the technology there. They just needed to develop a new software platform called Symbian. Now, everyone in middle management knew that Symbian didn't work, but they weren't going to tell the management because the senior management kept on saying, be positive, give us a positive story. The people who did say, hey, this isn't working, suddenly found their division was closed down, they were starved of resources. So people quickly learned just to tell the positive story. So the result is that they kept on developing this product, Symbian, which just wasn't going to work for over a year. And at that same time, Apple and also Samsung got a lead on them. And only after a year they were able to say, hey, this isn't working. They cut the project. But within a few years' time, Nokia had gone from a number one world mobile phone maker to basically being sold off to Microsoft for almost nothing.
Yes, it's a very cautionary tale. That is where we will wrap it up. Thank you very much for joining me today, Andre.
Thank you.
Andre Spicer is co-author of The Stupidity Paradox, The Power and Pitfalls of Functional Stupidity at Work. You'll find details on our homepage at abc.com.
rnshow.net.au/rn. Many jobs these days offer flexible working, and it can be a win-win. Great for the employee who needs to see the dentist, great for the employer who needs that project finished this week. But it can put a major strain on families. Mike Irving is a performance coach and mentor with consultancy Advanced Business Abilities.
I think the main issue is a lack of clarity on what all parties are saying yes to. A lack of clarity on the specific agreements that are being made and what those agreements involve. It's similar to having scope creep when you're working on a project. If you have flexibility in work to be able to take some time off during the day, that's fantastic. And what statistics are showing is that if somebody takes three hours off during the day on one day, all of a sudden over the course of the next week, they may end up working an extra 20 hours in their home time. Part of that's to do with the fact that they've got such easy access to all of their work tools on their smartphone. And it's creeping into and therefore impacting and affecting their family time, their social time, the time that is really reserved for them to rejuvenate and recreate themselves.
So it's a very grey area because it is really easy. And if you're trying to deal with someone in a different time zone, it's really easy to make that call or send that email.
It is. And so the agreements that I'm talking about being clear on, in my opinion, those are not just the agreements between you and where you work. They're also the agreements that you make with yourself. So if you're leaving work to go home and you know you've got a child or you've got a partner, are you really making an agreement with yourself to give those other people in your life your full attention when you're with them? Or are you really easily sidetracked by your phone? Or it even comes down to Facebook and Instagram. If there's so many roles right now that involve social media, and that can very easily be a 24-hour-a-day role.
So who is being taken advantage of here? Is it your family? Is it you?
I don't think that you can generalize the answer, because in certain circumstances, every person involved in this system can be taken advantage of. So it could be you. If you end up working 20 hours more than what's allocated in terms of your agreement at work, that's a good win for work. At the same time, it can be your family because they're not getting your time and your attention. It can be your friendships because they're not getting your time and your attention. And all of those things have a really big influence and impact on the general happiness that a person has in their life. Harvard's done a study, and what they've studied is what is it that contributes to and creates a happy life. And the number one thing is the quality of the relationships that you have. So this time that we have after work and the time that we have on weekends to spend with family and friends, that time's really important.
But if you spoke to any employer, none of them would say, look, I want to own, well, perhaps there are some. There might be some in high finance where you're staggeringly well remunerated and the pound of flesh is absolutely expected. But in most positions, you are not specifically expected to be on call all the time. If you have a written agreement, it will say something like work flexibly as needed.
Sure, which is totally not clear. That's part of the issue, I think, is that there's not a level of clarity on exactly what the agreement is. And it is a gray area. For me, it's not something that we can talk about and say, right, every single flexible workplace relationship is to go this way, because there's not one way. Different industries are going to have different impacts on flexibility. So the important thing is that if you yourself personally are in a situation where you've got flexibility, or where you as a company are giving flexibility, it's just really important that the individuals involved are clear on what those agreements are.
And I would imagine that is almost never discussed.
It's very limited in how often that's discussed, because emotions get in the way. You know, if you're the person who has flexibility, you're probably really grateful for that. And because you're really grateful, you want to make sure that you're not seen to be taking advantage of that. And so you do tend to want to put in those extra hours and do that little bit extra, which is admirable. And at the same time, it's about inspecting, well, okay, hold on, where is the line here? And what is the agreement I'm making with my employer?
And a part of the issue surely must be that there's no agreement in the way that a lawyer would recognize, mostly. What you have is a kind of informal belief that you hold that if you are allowed to nip off to the dentist or take your child to the doctor or something like that, that you will still get everything done and you will try to do as well as you can.
Yeah, it comes down to the fact that, yeah, you have that flexibility and you still have things to produce. So you've made a decision to say yes to producing those things. I find that it's not necessarily practical to have flexibility in terms of just hours. It's actually more important and seems to work better to have flexibility as long as you're producing the outputs.
So what sort of level are we talking about? How many, what kind of percentage of employees are working excessively outside of where we would expect them to work?
I would love to see the numbers on that. I don't have a specific figure. I can only go on my experience of the people that I've worked with and the firms that I've worked with. And what I've seen is 60, 70, sometimes even 80%.
All right. Well, you've also come up with some practical steps that we can take at home to make sure that we're connecting properly with the people we need to connect with at home. And one of them is a family diary appointment. That sounds kind of weird.
It does sound weird, doesn't it? It's a different way of looking at this whole concept of setting and making agreements with yourself and keeping the agreements that you make. So at work is generally full of appointments, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
There are times and there are set allocated numbers of hours to be able to work on certain tasks. Well, if you sort of take that idea and apply it to every part of your life, what you end up with is a series of agreements that you make with yourself. People who are really fit and active and healthy, they set appointments with themselves when they're going to go to the gym. They keep those agreements and they keep them consistently. If you apply a similar philosophy to family time, it's about being really clear that from this time to this time, you're giving your full attention to your child or you're giving your full attention to your partner. There was another study done over in the United States. It's now known that children spend a minimum 6.5 hours a day on screens, which is huge. It's just enormous.
It feels like that in my house sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine. I see it too. And there's a test that you can do online called the Reading the Eyes in the Mind test. And what it tests is your empathy skills, your ability to understand what's happening for someone. They gave these children this test, and then they took them away for 3 days, technology free. So 3 days playing outside, 3 days in the bush, essentially no screens at all. They then tested them at the end of the 3 days, and every single one of them improved. What that shows is that we actually get smarter by not staring at a screen and engaging with people.
I suppose that gets us into another point that you make about being present. So here and now, we're both very present. I'm listening hard to what you're saying and thinking about what I'm going to ask you next. You're thinking about the answer, but not every conversation at home is like that. Sometimes the telly's on, the phone's there, the kids are on Facebook. We're not as focused, perhaps, as we should be.
There's being present within yourself, in the now, is a word that can be used to describe that. There's another aspect to it, which is about giving your attention to the person that you're talking with. All really vital parts.
The way technology seems to be trending, this is getting more profound. So where are we going to be 5 or 10 years from now?
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about. With the advances that are being made right now in robotics and artificial intelligence, there's a whole bunch of people that are in roles right now that 10 years from now, people will not be performing. Even roles like lawyers and doctors, there will be robots and artificial intelligence that does that work. The most valuable skills that a person can develop for the next 40 years are going to be the skills of social interaction, physical human interaction. So communication skills, empathy skills. It is pretty scary to think that we technically can become less intelligent by spending all this time on screens. And studies are now showing that people that spend more time on Facebook are actually more likely to experience depression than those who don't. I think it's really important that people really get into and start practicing and developing those human interaction and connection skills.
So those things that we should be doing at home for our own health, for the good of the people we love and live with, they might help us have a job in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're certainly going to help us to ensure that we've got quality relationships, which that's the number one thing that impacts happiness.
Mike Irving. And that's it for this week. Best Practice is produced by Murata Dias. Our sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Adie.